Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals are provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information. The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed in this podcast are solely of those of the hosts.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chimanchu, and I'm here with my friend and co-host, Dr. Sam Mazur, and our producer, Steve Wilson. What's up, guys?
Hey.
What's up, guys?
We have an amazing four-time repeat guest, Dr. Michelle Starr, always the star, here to discuss an amazing topic, an evergreen topic. I know everyone loves this topic, is renal tubular acidosis. But first, Sam, remind us why we're here.
Absolutely, Chris. We are the pediatric medicine podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our return guest, Dr. Michelle Starr. Dr. Starr is a pediatric nephrologist who works at the Indiana University School of Medicine and Riley Hospital for Children, where she cares for children with kidney disease. Her research focuses on neonatal kidney disease, specifically fluid overload and acute kidney injury, but she's also passionate about medical education, social determinants of health, and improving outcomes for children on acute dialysis. She teaches us about types 1, 2, and 4 RTAs, and even something about type 3 RTAs.
Steve, do you think our listeners will have any trouble following along what we're talking about?
No PhD required for this episode. We'll make sure we provide a buffer of knowledge for you to become an RTA expert.
Hello, Dr. Starr. Welcome back to the show.
I am excited to be here again. Thanks for having me.
Is this the fourth one? I think you get a special jacket for this one.
Ooh.
Yeah, well, and then Billy Crystal will be on later to say hi.
That sounds pretty exciting.
And of course, because we're in a formal group, it's okay if I call you by your first name, Michelle?
Absolutely.
Excellent. So we have a jam-packed episode today, so we're going to skip some of the rapid-fire questions. But in case some people did not listen to our other episodes with you, do you mind just sort of describing yourself a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a pediatric nephrologist and fortunately four-time recurrent guest. And I am at Indiana University and Riley Children's Health in Indianapolis, Indiana.
My alma mater. Fantastic place.
Whether this is your first episode or you've been with us since day one, you know our goal has always been to share clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and maybe a fun pun in pediatric medicine. So let's talk about something that actually changed my day-to-day as a hospitalist, and that's figs. I can't walk into a clinic or hospital without seeing people in fig scrubs. And I get it. I wear them too. They're incredibly soft, form-fitting, and durable. And it's not just us. If you've been watching a certain popular ER drama on TV that may or may not take place in Pittsburgh, PA, yep, they're in figs too. These scrubs get it. That's what drew me in and what keeps me coming back. And because we work with kids and kids come with messes, I love that figs are antimicrobial. When stuff gets on your scrubs, and it will, you just wash them and they come out wrinkle-free. I've washed mine over 50 times and they still look brand new. So Cribsiders listeners, with back-to-school season upon us, it's the perfect time to stock up on some fresh outfits for the year. And figs just dropped a brand new collection of limited edition styles and accessories. So get 15% off your first order at wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX, F-I-G-S-R-X.
All right, Steve, I think we should jump into it because you've got quite a stem here for this case.
That sounds great. I'll start us off with our first case. So you're the admitting physician on a general inpatient pediatric service and receive a phone call from the emergency department. They tell you that they would like to admit Philip Trait, a 12-month-old ex-full-term previously healthy boy referred into the ED by his primary pediatrician due to several weeks of polyuria and failure to thrive. Despite a robust appetite and seemingly normal development, he continues to lose weight. He had previously been following along the 35th percentile on his growth curve, but has recently crossed two percentile lines. His parents also remarked that he has greater than 12 wet diapers per day, yet may go a day or more at a time without having a bowel movement. Lab workup in the emergency department revealed a pH of 7.25, a PCO2 of 30, sodium of 140, potassium of 3.2, chloride of 120, bicarbonate of 14, and a normal creatinine. Your analysis demonstrates a pH of 6.5 with low specific gravity. Urine calcium to creatinine ratio is 0.9, and renal ultrasound shows diffuse nephrocalcinosis. Philip is admitted for further evaluation and nephrology consultation. So I want to start super, super basic after that long stem. What, Michelle, what defines a metabolic acidosis?
So this is where we have to start with all these. Before anybody runs screaming or crying from the room or calls to nephrology, the first thing we need to think about is what is the underlying acid-base disorder? So that's where all of these questions start. I think the really nice thing about this very excellent stem is that we have all of the information to really kind of find a solid footing and figure out where we're at. So the first thing to remember when we're starting to think about acid-base disorders is that you need a pH. So I get called a lot about RTAs or concerns for metabolic acid or acid-base disorders without a pH. So remember, before you even start to think about RTA, you truly need to assess whether the patient is acidemic or alkalemic before you really start. So this patient has a pH, a CO2, and a bicarb, which are all moving in the same direction, right? They are all low. So this patient has metabolic acidosis. And then the next thing you need to figure out is whether there's a gap or not. This math's pretty simple, but really what we're trying to say is whether this is a anion gap acidosis, which has several mnemonics depending on your favorite way of approaching these things, or whether this is a non-anion gap acidosis, which is where everybody starts to get a little nervous and starts to think about calling nephrology. So this patient has a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis, which is characterized by a high chloride as kind of the predominant feature when you calculate out the gap.
And I think it's probably wise to keep going through this non-anion gap metabolic acidosis piece. You know, we could talk about, you know, the gap parts, but we have a lot to get to. So we'll just kind of go down this non-anion gap metabolic acidosis. So within that category, once you've made that step, what is now your differential diagnosis?
So there's three big buckets we think about in terms of non-anion gap metabolic acidosis. So the first thing to remember when you're admitting in a patient and you have a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis is that RTA is not the first or second thing on your differential. When you're admitting a patient with a non-anion gap acidosis, you want to think about horses and not zebras. And while RTA is more common in pediatrics than adult patients, the most common thing that we see patients who have a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis is GI losses. So GI losses such as diarrhea is the number one cause. GI losses, I feel like there's a joke there about number one cause or something like that. But when you think about GI losses, usually this is also accompanied by a low potassium. And so this is kind of the first clue, right? You are going to have a non-anion gap acidosis. You often will have hypokalemia. And you're going to have a story that usually fits. So a patient might be admitted with vomiting, diarrhea, dehydration, and those are the things that are going to make you think about GI losses as your first cause of a non-GAP acidosis.
Now, can you explain how GI losses contributes to an acidosis? Because I think some people may not understand, especially, you know, we started off here, you gave us a bunch of numbers. We see a low potassium and a high chloride, especially compared to the sodium. So we're thinking hyperchloric acidosis, but how does things that you lose by your GI tract associate with that?
So really what we need to think about is bicarb loss in this situation. So really we're thinking about ways by which you either lose bicarbonate, which the kidneys do a lot of, but your GI tract does a lot of as well. So these are situations in which you are losing too much bicarbonate and the compensatory mechanisms are not in place to adequately kind of help with that, at least acutely. So diarrhea is the most common thing that we see this in, but you can also see it in a couple other situations. So kids who have surgical drains can sometimes present with this sort of picture. Very rarely, we will see kids who have urologic procedures where they have kind of diversions. So like ileal chimneys or things like that can have diversions. And the reason we see it in that situation is that the GI tract is not equipped to handle the low pH that the uroepithelium is. And so the GI tract actually absorbs those fluids. And so you basically get reabsorption of hydrogen. So when you have any sort of urine in bowel, any sort of surgical drainage, or any excess GI losses, usually diarrhea, that's going to be the most common cause.
And that sounds like that's kind of bucket number one, right? You're giving all these things, but it's essentially like GI, not necessary urinary losses of bicarbonate.
Correct. So the kind of bucket number one is any sort of gastrointestinal losses of bicarb or inappropriate reclamation of hydrogen.
Perfect. So what about number two?
Bucket number two is, I think, increasingly common, particularly in our ICU patients. So I call this chloride intoxication. You also can call this misuse of normal saline. But what basically can happen in this situation is when you are delivering high amounts of chloride, you basically get a clinical picture, which can sometimes fool people into thinking that you have an RTA.
And then just out of curiosity, can you get that without getting intravenous versions of this? Like, can a kid drink something or anything along those lines? Or are we really thinking this patient is iatrogenic?
So the amounts, I mean, we could theoretically, I mean, I've seen some toddlers do some really impressive things, not just in the hospital, but also in my life. But, you know, most of the time, these are high volumes of IV fluids. So I don't usually worry about the amount of normal saline I'm giving until a patient is really requiring a very high amount of it. So the two big adult trials that looked at this, which were out of Vanderbilt, basically found that it's after about 2 or 3 liters is really where you start to see this effect. So this is a patient I'm worried about, you know, massive volume resuscitation, going to the ICU after 2 or 3 boluses, then you're going to want to start thinking about fluid composition and whether normal saline is truly the correct choice for a patient. Because if you don't make a change, you may start to see a non-GAP acidosis start to evolve over the next 24 to 48 hours.
And of course, we might see this less and less these days as there tends to be a shift towards other balanced fluids like LR and plasmolyte, especially in our trauma situations and these situations, you think?
Absolutely. You know, the other patient population I see this in more and more, I think, is DKA. So as DKA patients are resolving, then they sometimes start to develop, as their GAP acidosis goes away and their glucose starts to get under control, then they'll start to develop a non-GAP acidosis and really just mess with the ICU.
Do we know the mechanism by which you get an acidosis from IV fluids? I think at some point it was explained to me that essentially your kidneys are swapping out the chloride for bicarb, and so you're wasting bicarb through your kidneys.
So that's the major piece of it. The other piece to remember is that these fluids are truly not balanced, and the pH of these solutions are so acidotic that we really are infusing very, very low pH fluids in high volumes.
Yeah, the way I like to think about like high chloride acid solutions is, you know, your ratio between sodium and chloride, right? So in our normal saline, sodium and chloride are equal. So, you know, I like to calculate what we call a strong ion difference. So that's like zero. Whereas like in our patient right here, where their sodium is 140 and their chloride's 120, their strong ion difference is 20. So that's much lower than a normal 38. So you can sort of see how much more acidotic like a normal saline is, even compared to like our patients, like chemistries here.
So Chris will be entering nephrology next week and joining me.
So Steve, I think we were going to ask something, because now that we have figured out like some symptomatic things, I think we need to move on from there, right?
Yeah. So let's say we've sort of ruled out buckets one or two. There's nothing anatomical going on here. There's no GI symptoms. And now we're starting to consider RTA in our differential diagnosis. Can you define what an RTA is and tell us when we should be considering this diagnosis?
Absolutely. So, you know, marching through the two other kind of more common causes of non-GAP acidosis really sets us up well to think about what happens when we have struck out with those two and we're actually thinking that this is the kidney's fault. I will caveat this and say the kidney is trying really, really hard, and the kidney is actually asked to do quite a bit here. So I think what we really need to think about is, what is RTA and what's the kidney supposed to be doing? So RTA, it's in the name, it's renal tubular acidosis, right? So this is basically a non-GAP acidosis, which is due to failure of the kidney to either reabsorb bicarbonate or secrete hydrogen ions. So In order to truly understand RTA, and this actually works out really nicely with the pathophysiology of the different types, you need to understand the different roles of the kidney and the things that we actually ask it to do on a daily basis. So the first thing is that we ask the kidney to reabsorb pretty much all of the bicarbonate in the body. Bicarbonate is freely filtered at the glomerulus, and the proximal tubule has to reabsorb pretty much all of it. So if you do the math, which is my favorite pastime, and you assume that someone has a normal GFR, right? This patient has a normal serum creatinine. We assume their kidney function is normal. And, you know, if you give someone a normal bicarb and assume that they are filtering appropriately, the kidney actually has to reclaim over 3,500 millimoles of bicarb in a day. So if you break that number into the number of bicarb pills that you would have to take to basically replace the role of the kidney, the giant sodium bicarbonate tabs that we have are 650 milligrams. You would have to take about 18 pills an hour to compensate for what the proximal tubule is doing.
I like that. That I can understand. I was like, I don't know if I know the millimoles, but 18 pills an hour, that sounds like a lot.
That's incredible to think about because when you look at outside, you know, we're talking about RTAs and non-GAP acidoses now. With our GAP acidoses, the bicarb is what's filling all those other things. So throughout all the time when the kidney's trying to do its job and it's filling all that bicarb. So I can only imagine what is going through during the other type of acidoses when it's trying to do its job.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I respect the kidney so much, right? This is nephrology 101, but you just have to kind of appreciate the amount of grunt work that the proximal tubule is doing just to kind of keep pace. So that's in states of health, right? So that is the major job of the proximal tubule. So when we talk about what happens when it goes sideways, remember, that's what it's trying to do. The second major function, so the proximal tubule is really just kind of the workhorse proximal tubule reabsorption of bicarb. The second thing that the kidney needs to do in the distal part of the tubule is synthesize new bicarbonate to kind of offset the normal daily acid load. So in taking in the normal diet that we take in, particularly amino acids and protein base, there's just a need for bicarbonate to break these things down. So particularly a couple of the amino acids require bicarb. And so bicarb is basically absorbed by the body as it's trying to get rid of these amino acids. And so there's a need to basically offset that by replenishing kind of this normal metabolism. So this is what the distal tubule does in terms of kind of this like resynthesis. In adults, we usually quote about 1 millimole per kilo per day. Kids are a lot more metabolically active and need a lot more. So kids, it's about 2 to 3. In babies, it's about 4 to 5 millimoles per kilo per day. So the kidney, particularly the distal tubule, is kind of doing quite a bit of work when it comes to kind of that reclamation and that kind of resynthesis.
And what does it synthesize it out of, just so we have a better understanding there? So it just creates it out of nowhere, or is it created out of something that we are also secreting or something along those lines?
Yeah, so it basically works through a couple different pathways. Yes, the kidney is a magic black box, but yes, it basically takes several different building blocks and uses a couple of exchangers to kind of build it out of our other building blocks. But the most important thing to remember is that it's the amino acid breakdown that really is what's triggering it. So a lot of this is actually diet mediated. So, you know, in people who eat a very protein heavy or very Western diet, they may actually have a higher need. And this is important when we think about management of RTAs and how we actually kind of try and treat these things, because the need for bicarbonate and bicarbonate replacement depends on what someone is eating in their day.
Perfect.
The distal tubule's third job, which I think of slightly differently because it helps in terms of kind of breaking down the different types of RTA, is it helps to excrete hydrogen ions, okay? And so that's the third job. It's kind of part of that second job, but I like to think about it separately because it keeps my brain straight when I'm thinking about the different types of RTA. So you have a couple different ways of getting rid of hydrogen, okay? One of my favorite mentors used to say, P can't spark, which is a really fun thing to say, but also is a really good reminder that we can't just excrete hydrogen, right? You have to have it as part of kind of either a titratable acid, so something like hydrogen phosphate, or have some other pathway. So there's two different ways we get rid of hydrogen in the urine. The first is through hydrogen phosphate, which is a titratable acid. That is something that can't upregulate. It's kind of a set it and forget it. It's really good for baseline needs, but doesn't really upregulate when you have something else going on. The second way is actually through the excretion of ammonium. And so what happens with that is that you have ammonia, NH3, which then can be coupled to an extra hydrogen to NH4, which then can be excreted in the urine. That's really important when we think about our evaluation of gap acidosis in RTA, when we think about the urine gap calculation. So that's really what we think about there.
All right. I'm going to try to summarize. I think we can we're going to take a step back from the physiology and ask another follow-up question, but let me see if I can get this right. So we kind of get three different locations or three different jobs of the kidney when it comes to acid base in this manner. It sounds like we have the proximal tubule and the distal tubule, but the distal has actually two jobs, which is the thing that we were just trying to clarify. The proximal tubule, why, is just essentially just straight reabsorption, just reabsorb bicarb more than any of us can take via a pill. In the distal convoluted tubule, the job is to both create sodium bicarb, or at least bicarbonate, sorry, not sodium bicarb, but create bicarbonate as a result of pretty much all the amino acids that you eat, and then also to excrete extra acid, which can be excreted in two manners, either by ammonia to ammonium, or if I'm doing that wrong, ammonium to ammonia, it's probably the second one. And then also this hydrogen phosphate piece that's a titratable acid. Does that sound like the ways in which we manage?
Yes.
Awesome.
You got it.
Awesome.
Nephrology right. Fellowship completed.
I know. Well, I was going to say, I got to follow Chris. I'll be the next year. Nice. Before we kind of get into each of these problems, like, you know, it sounds like each of these problems get perturbed, right? And it's our job to try to figure that out and go from there. I want to take one kind of step back and ask a little bit about the clinical side of an RTA before we kind of get into this nitty gritty. So clinically speaking, you know, Steve brought up a case with failure to thrive, for example, other things like that. What are generally the clinical manifestations of an RTA?
So the RTAs are all slightly different in terms of the ways in which they present. But they are all kind of in this bucket of failure to thrive, right? So these infants usually are they're in a negative energy balance, and they are in a state of kind of chronic acidemia, and you do not grow well when you are chronically acidemic. So these infants or small children are usually poorly grown, particularly with respect to their height or their length. They usually tend to have more maintained weight, but really we'll start to see their growth falter. There are other associated findings in terms of kidney stones or nephrocalcinosis, depending on the type of RTA that we will commonly see. And then sometimes depending on the underlying kind of defect, especially with some of the genetic manifestations, we'll see hearing loss as well. But really, failure to thrive is the major unifying thing. Usually urine output is maintained. And so these kids tend to be either polyuric or have normal urine output, but tend to grow very poorly.
So are there any ways, like any earlier signs that we might catch? Because it sort of sucks to catch a kid by the time they're already failure to thrive. Like, any other possible way that we'd be able to catch these?
I mean, I think the clinical clues are really paying attention to either urine output. I'm not going to say check everybody's urine or get urine gaps on everybody, because there aren't enough nephrologists in the world for those urine gap interpretations. But really, it's to kind of get a good sense of infant's growth and to get a good sense of family history as well, because especially in these early onset RTAs, you most commonly are going to have some sort of family history, or you're going to have some sort of sense that something like this may run in a family.
Now, you said this term urine gap multiple times, and we've definitely had a couple acid base episodes, so I think people know how to measure like anion gaps, and I think, you know, we didn't have to rehash that this episode. But you said urine gap, and What is this urine gap? Do I have to check urine to look at it? Are we looking at the same electrolytes we normally would with blood? Like, can you explain this a little bit and how does this help us?
Yeah. So this is, I'm a nephrology nerd, but I feel like urine gap is really when we particularly nerd out even more. So, you know, like I was saying before, urine can't spark. So your number of anions and your number of cations have to be equal. Now, this would be really easy if we had a urine test for ammonium, but we don't. Technically, they could do it, but they have to recalibrate the lab sensor. And so instead, what we're trying to do with a urine gap is basically assess whether there is enough urinary ammonium to kind of compensate for what is going on. So remember when we talked earlier about the job of the kidney and the distal part of the kidney? Really what we're trying to say is that mechanism intact? So the way that we do a urine gap, and so this is something if you were clinically worried about a patient having an RTA, something that if you send at the time that you're calling nephrology will make us very, very happy. And so the three pieces that you need are a urine sodium, a urine potassium, and a urine chloride. And what you're basically doing is comparing your cations, your sodium and your potassium, to your anion, which is your chloride. And those are the three major contributors. And what you basically do is you subtract the total of your sodium plus your potassium, and then from that you subtract your chloride. And then you're looking at that gap. And so what you're really comparing is whether your two positive charges are bigger or smaller than your chloride. And that basically allows you to say how much ammonium is there and is it sufficient for what is happening in the clinical scenario.
And maybe we should just back up ever so slightly here and talk a little bit about diagnosis. And then because it sounds like this test is probably going to be helpful on telling us what type of RTA we're dealing with. Is there any test that we need to send right off the bat to confirm a diagnosis of RTA, or is it just a diagnosis of exclusion to say, hey, you're not getting chloride fluids and you're not having diarrhea?
So the first thing that you need to think about is confirming that you truly have all the elements of an RTA, right? So you need a VBG and you need electrolytes to truly confirm that you have a metabolic disorder and that it is a non-GAP acidosis. It's also important to remember that you certainly could have a patient who has an RTA, but if they also have diarrhea or they're receiving excess chloride fluids, you really cannot uncover that until you deal with those other two things first. So really, you need to kind of first suss out the clinical scenario, get those serum labs to kind of figure out whether you're in the kind of appropriate space to even be thinking or entertaining a diagnosis of RTA. The other thing I'll say about the laboratory assessment is that particularly for folks who are practicing outpatient pediatrics and might be seeing a patient with concern for failure to thrive, that these are tests that are most well analyzed when they're performed in a lab that is able to perform the test as well. And what I mean by that is when a tube of blood sits out for a period of time, there is a little bit of loss of the bicarb. And so you can actually get a kind of a pseudo RTA if a sample sits for a period of time where the bicarb might look falsely low and the pH might falsely look low. So if you have a high suspicion for a patient truly having an RTA, this is a patient you want to send to a local children's hospital or someone that can do a venipuncture and draw those labs and run those within the hour or 2 hours.
And so just to follow that up, it sounds like we actually, we're hitting with all these pieces, but it's ultimately a clinical concern that you have. And by clinical, I mean, you know, talking through the history and the meds that we've been gotten before. And then, so what's the next level of testing? You know, when do we send the urine, you know, all that type of good stuff.
So if you have a non-GAP acidosis that fits the kind of clinical picture of an RTA, and you have eliminated GI losses, and you have eliminated chloride as kind of contributing factors, that's when you want to get a urine gap. And what a urine gap is going to allow you to do is say, is the kidney functioning appropriately in the setting of this non-GAP acidosis? And so what your GAP will tell you is whether your kidney is functioning or whether your kidney is unable to kind of compensate. So if you have a negative GAP, I have always learned the mnemonic negative. So if you have a negative GAP, it means that there are GI losses. And a negative GAP basically says that the kidney is compensating by creating enough ammonium to compensate for what is happening. So if you have a negative urine GAP, that is indicative of a non-RTA cause of your non-GAP acidosis. If you have a positive urine GAP, that's when you call nephrology and you say, hey, I have a patient who has a non-ion GAP, metabolic acidosis. Yes, I got your GAP. Yes, it's positive. And would you like to come see this patient?
And I think I can interpret this because when you have a negative GAP, what you're saying is that there's essentially extra. So actually your cations are down because you have more ammonium. That's actually the thing that you can't measure, and therefore it's kind of balancing out. But if you have a positive GAP, it means you actually are down on your chloride and would imply that there's bicarb that's somewhere in that urine that's the negative. Is that kind of how to interpret that?
That's exactly right. So there's this thing called a gambogram, which I think I get my nephrology card taken away if I don't mention it on an RTA episode. But it's basically a way of thinking about how cations and anions balance each other. And that is exactly what you summarized, Sam.
If you've ever listened to a heart murmur and thought, did I really hear that? You're not alone. I've had moments in the wards where I thought I caught something subtle, maybe a faint gallop or an irregular rhythm, but with background noise, a restless patient, and no time for a second opinion, I just had to move on. That's where Echo Health came in. Being able to record the sound meant I could revisit it later, and with the help of Echo's AI, I got confirmation that what I heard wasn't just in my head. It's like having a second set of expert ears, even after you've left the room. So Echo combines the stethoscope you already know with enhanced audio and advanced AI to help you detect heart and lung conditions earlier and with more confidence. With Echo, you can hear with precision, even in noisy environments. Their digital stethoscope amplifies heart and lung sounds up to 40 times, and noise cancellation cuts out distractions. You can also detect disease earlier. Unlock murmur and AFib detection powered by Echo AI, along with sound recording sharing and more for earlier diagnoses and seamless collaborations. And lastly, it improves diagnostic accuracy. Backed by millions of heart sounds and 8 FDA clearances for devices and AI algorithms, clinical studies show that those who use Echo are 2 times more likely to detect heart disease. And a personal benefit? Teaching. I've used Echo recordings to walk learners through abnormal heart and lung sounds, and even to help patients better understand what's going on with their own bodies. It turns the stethoscope from a black box into a real-time teaching tool. So we trust Echo so much that we worked with their team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get up to $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/cribsiders. Your purchase may be HSA and FSA eligible and may also qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you'll detect heart and lung conditions more confidently. And if you don't, return it for a full refund. So again, go to echohealth.com/cribsiders for up to $50 off, plus a free chest piece cover. That's ekohealth.com/cribsiders.
So my question is, are there other cations that could be potentially give you a a falsely negative in urine anion GAP?
So there are. They usually in normal states contribute very small amounts. So the only situation where I really feel like they are either cations or anions mess with our interpretation of a GAP is in toxic alcohol ingestions, where they sometimes can muddy the picture. But most of the time, that's not a patient that you're worried about RTA because they have 1.5 million other things going on.
Gotcha. Well, toxic alcohol is a whole other episode I'm sure we can do.
Can't wait.
So I guess that I hinted at this a little bit by asking that question. So Our urine anion gap, then, overall, it's fairly sensitive and specific, then, you're telling us.
It's actually a great test. So the thing to remember is that it really needs to be performed at the time that you are assessing your serum labs as well. So that's why it's really important, because what it's telling you is how is the kidney responding to the overall kind of clinical picture. So if you get urine studies 12, 24 hours later after your lab assessment, it's really tricky to assess kind of how those two work together.
So I just want to kind of bring it back to our case, because I think now we can start. I think we have a lot of information, right? We've now understand how to make a diagnosis of RTA. We understand what we're doing when we're calling nephrology and why. And so now we're about to call our nephrologist here and kind of ask that next kind of step question of which RTA is it and how do you figure this out? So if we go back to our patient right now, actually, guys, I don't know if we don't actually have urine lights, right, on this patient. So let's pretend that we have, well, not pretend, excuse me. I will just, you know, this is definitely what's going on here. So we'll say, you know, Philip Trait here, we definitely have a low pH. We definitely have a low PCO2. We definitely have a low bicarbonate. We have no diarrhea. We have no fluids. Okay, great. Now we send the urine electrolytes to find the urine anion gap. Okay. Let's say we have a positive gap. So now that we have a positive gap, what's our next step in trying to figure out what type of RTA this is, so then we can kind of walk through what our treatment might be?
So this is where you call your friendly nephrologist and they pat you on the back for having done all the appropriate studies, because you have basically just diagnosed a patient with RTA. The question now is, where is the defect and what do you do about it, both in terms of further evaluation and in terms of management? Now, I will kind of let the cat out of the bag here. The answer is bicarb for pretty much all of these. The question is how much and anything else, basically. So the answer at the end of the day is going to be give this patient bicarb. But the kind of first step is, where is the problem? Is there any other associated problem we have to worry about? And, you know, what do we need to do in terms of workup? So let's talk about this patient and talk about some of the context clues that I'm getting from the stem and then how it points me in my kind of RTA sniffing brain to where I think the defect is. So the other things we talked about with this patient is that they have poor growth, right? This is a baby who is polyuric, who is not growing well. The other things that we kind of know about this baby is that they have low potassium. So the other thing that you really want to pay attention to when you're thinking about RTA is what's the potassium, because that's going to help you think about where the defect is. This baby also has high urine calcium, which is also going to help us think about where the defect is as well. So I think probably what makes the most sense is to just talk about the different RTAs and just talk about what they are and then figure out where this kid fits the best. I think sometimes people get overwhelmed by the different RTAs because, quite honestly, the naming and numbering makes no sense.
So Michelle, do you want to, I think this is a good time that maybe you can walk us through all the different type of RTAs and how you think about them, because honestly, I just get confused and I go cross-eyed every time I think about it.
Yeah, well, I do too sometimes. So I think that the way I usually think about these is I kind of think about the nephron in order. So I think that makes me a typical nephrologist, always thinking about the nephron. But the way I think about it is based on where the defect is. So classically, we think about different RTAs as numbers, right? So there's 1, 2, 4, and then depending who you talk to, sometimes there may be a 3. And we'll get into that in a second. But really, I actually think the better way to think about this is where the defect is. So let's start and talk about proximal RTA. So this gets back when we talked about what the kidney is actually doing. So proximal RTA is also known as type 2 RTA. So if you're struggling to remember how to do that. I think about 2 as kind of a twisty number and the proximal tubule is twisty. And so that's how I remember that type 2 is proximal RTA. So remember that the proximal tubule is doing all of the work of bicarbonate reabsorption. So there is no such thing as a complete proximal RTA because you would not survive. It is something that is really just not compatible with acid-base homeostasis that's compatible with life. So all of our defects that are proximal RTAs are kind of partial defects. And what ends up happening with them is that they reset the TM, which you may remember from your kind of hyperglycemia days as that threshold at which the kidney is able to reabsorb things. So this may be bringing back bad memories of glucose or glucose homeostasis. So we think about the TM usually in the context of hyperglycemia. So the TM for glucose is about 200. So kind of the way to think about that is if your glucose is under 200, the kidney, particularly the proximal tubule, is able to reabsorb all of that glucose. Everything has a TM in the kidney. There's things that the threshold is just not able to reabsorb. And there's one for bicarb as well. So the TM for bicarb in the proximal tubule is usually around 28. And so what happens with a proximal tubulopathy is you basically get a lowered threshold. And so the kidney is not able to reabsorb when it gets kind of it gets below that number. So instead of having a TM of like 26, 28, you are happily floating along with your bicarb of 24 because your kidney is able to tolerate that really nicely and reabsorb everything. In a proximal RTA, your TM or your threshold gets reset to like 14 to 16. And so what happens over time is that your bicarb and your serum slowly drifts down until you reach that new set point. And then your kidney is able to compensate at least partially and maintain that serum bicarb where it's at. But you have this period where everything kind of drifts down as your kidney is kind of getting used to that new set point.
Awesome. That sounds good to me. I'm ready.
And TM stands for, is that tubular maximum? Is that what it is?
Threshold of maximum reabsorption.
Okay. All right.
So it's something we usually just think about in the setting of DKA and diabetes, but I find it really helpful when I'm thinking about what the proximal tubule is trying to do in terms of bicarb. So the other thing to remember with a proximal tubular acidosis is that the rest of the kidney is actually able to do what it needs to. So why this matters is that your distal mechanisms are still intact. And so your urine is actually able to still acidify. So you can get a low urine pH because you're still able to excrete your hydrogen ions, either kind of titratable acids or kind of mixed into ammonium. And so you are still able to get your urine pH lower. That's different when we start thinking about our distal RTAs, but that's one of our really good context clues when we're trying to figure out whether something is a distal or a proximal defect.
That makes sense. So essentially the distal system is the one that actually is in charge of putting acid in. And so therefore acid in is the thing that's going to see the urinary pH. So if you're anything proximal, it shouldn't affect that system. Is that kind of a good way to think about it?
Yep. So think about them as even though they're trying to do the same job, they're kind of uncoupled. And so you're still going to see the clinical manifestations of an RTA, but your urine is usually going to help you figure it out. So with a type 2, your urine is going to be, your urine pH is going to be low. It's usually less than 5.5 because those compensatory mechanisms are really trying to get rid of things and are able to function well. The other things are often context clues in a proximal RTA is you very commonly can see stones, particularly calcium phosphate stones. And these kids, especially if they have longstanding RTA, will actually have abnormalities in their bone and bony growth because they're trying to buffer their acids elsewhere in their body, mostly in their bone.
Can you explain that a little bit in more detail from a physiologic perspective? I just don't understand why is the TM changing for calcium 2 in the proximal tubule, or are we just, how are we buffering somewhere else in the body that I just don't understand?
So there's a couple of different mechanisms. So a lot of times with a proximal RTA, you are also having other abnormalities, right? You have other channels that are also impacted. And so a lot of times you are just getting excess calcium. The other thing is that calcium is kind of one of those things that gets kind of thrown by the wayside when your body is trying to buffer acids. And so there's a lot of exchangers that are basically trying to maintain your acid-based homeostasis and do it at kind of the consequence of calcium. But one of the major reasons, quite honestly, is that calcium is leaky and leaks through a lot of these channels, particularly in the state of proximal tubular dysfunction.
Awesome. That's good. That's good. No bones. Let's just stick with straight kidneys and anions.
So you can see calcium stones and elevated urine calcium in all of the RTAs. It depends a little bit. It's more common in distal and in proximal than type 4. But you certainly can, depending on what the underlying abnormality is, see differences in urine calcium excretion, which may lead to calcium stones.
So we've talked a little bit about different ions that are affected, electrolytes that are effective with both your proximal RTA and distal RTA. We've talked about hydrogen. We talked about bicarb. Are there other electrolytes we need to worry about? I feel like potassium's got to be affected in there somewhere. And how does that look between our proximal and distal RTAs?
So potassium is really going to be one of the most helpful things in helping you differentiate a type 4 RTA than a type 1 and 2. So type 1 and type 2, so proximal and distal, are usually going to have low potassium. There's a couple of caveats to that when we think about distal RTA we'll talk about in a few minutes. But type 4 RTA usually has hyperkalemia. And so when you're trying to distinguish between those, that can be really helpful. The other thing that we should always think about with proximal RTA is that these are sometimes defects that affect multiple areas of the proximal tubule. So the most common kind of global cause of a proximal tubulopathy is Fanconi syndrome, where you're not just going to see abnormalities in your acid base. You're not just going to see RTA, but you're going to see low phosphorus. You're going to see glucose spilling as well. And so your urine is going to show a bland urine with glucose. Sometimes you'll see protein as well. You're going to see elevated urine calcium, and the patient is going to have hypophosphatemia as well. We can also see this with cystinosis. Cystinosis will present with failure to thrive and a Fanconi-like picture with proximal tubulopathy as well. There's a couple other disorders as well that can also present with kind of this diffuse proximal tubulopathy that sometimes just gets picked up on a blood test when someone gets worried about failure to thrive.
So you just brought up a couple of things that can cause RTAs. And we jumped right in and we talked about, all right, we have these symptoms. This is how we diagnose acidosis and RTAs. But we sort of glossed a little bit over, like, how do people get RTAs? Like, is this something that can happen spontaneously? Are people predisposed to it? Is this something that can be caused by medications or infections and things like that? Can you talk about that a little bit before we move on a little bit, just so that we can sort of get a little bit of bearings now that we sort of have an idea what RTAs are?
Yeah. And then I think, you know, we can kind of go back to this case in terms of thinking about what's the best fit for this patient. But let's think about it in a couple of different buckets. So yes, there can be kind of underlying genetic causes. So especially in young kids or babies, genetics is going to be one of the first things I think about. So there are genetic causes of both proximal and distal, as well as type 4 RTA. So those are sometimes associated with other syndromes. So sometimes we'll present with a cluster of other clinical manifestations. So yes, there are primary genetic causes. This kidney can sometimes be a harbinger of other kind of systemic illness. So sometimes these RTAs can be kind of a first presentation of an other illness. So for example, distal RTA can sometimes be a first presentation of lupus, and some can sometimes be a first presentation of Sjogren's as well. The other kind of big bucket is medications. And so there are medications that can do all of these things, sometimes by design, if they are a medication that is targeted to kind of work on one of these channels. But there are also medications that can cause each of these syndromes because of the way that they work as well.
Hey, Cribsiders listeners, are you a pediatrician ready to focus on what matters most, your patients? Well, the Permanente Medical Group in Northern California is seeking pediatric physicians to join their multidisciplinary practice, serving families across 21 medical centers with an 80-year legacy of excellence. So here's what sets them apart. No RVUs, no billing headaches, no practice overhead, just you providing exceptional care in a physician-led, mission-driven environment. They offer flexible schedules, a competitive salary and benefits package, moving and relocation assistance, and Northern California home buying assistance. Plus, they are PSLF eligible. Whether you're drawn to Northern California's natural beauty, year-round recreational amenities, or vibrant communities, they have locations you'll love to call home. Visit northerncalifornia.permanente.org to learn how you can help them fulfill the promise of medicine at Kaiser Permanente Northern California. Again, that's northerncalifornia.permanente.org. Awesome. So we just kind of covered what we'd call proximal or type 2 RTA. Is there anything else that we should know about that before we kind of talk about the next one in the line?
No, I don't think so. So just to recap really quickly with a type 2 or a proximal RTA, this is basically where your TM or your threshold resets. You will have a non-GAP acidosis with a positive urine net charge. You're going to have a low urine pH. You're going to usually have a low potassium as well. And sometimes you might either have diffuse tubular dysfunction. So you might have things like hypophosphatemia, urine glucose, or urine calcium, or you might have a medication or another syndrome that is pointing you the right direction with it.
That's a perfect summary. That's great.
Do we want to talk about how we treat this patient since we think they have type 2 or type 1? Wait, what do we decide on this one? Steve, guide us back here. I'm confused.
So this is a proximal RTA, which is type 2, which is not quite our patient Philip trait, but we're going to get there. Let's complete where we were going. So So we were just doing kind of which of, I can kind of describe each of these RTAs. So so the first one we just described is type 2, and then I'm hopeful we're going to talk about type 1 next, but we'll see what Michelle has to say.
Yeah, so the next type of RTA is distal RTA. So we talked about proximal or type 2. Distal is type 1. If you are still trying to struggle with the numbers, the way I remember distal RTA being 1 is the distal tubule is a straight line. And so for me, that works in my simple brain. So when we think about what distal RTA is, we just have to think about what the distal tubule is trying to do to maintain homeostasis, okay? So there's actually three different steps and three different things it does. And so there's three different ways you can get distal RTA in the kidney. So hang with me. I promise we'll walk through it together. So the first thing that actually the distal tubule does is that it reabsorbs sodium. So no nephrologist is going to not talk about ENaC, but there's these ENaC channels in the distal tubule, which is where sodium is reabsorbed. So the first thing that has to happen is sodium gets reabsorbed. Now, why is this important for acid secretion? It basically is what sets up this gradient, okay? And so sodium gets reabsorbed in the proximal tubule. The second thing that happens is that you get hydrogen pumped back into the urine. Okay, so that gradient helps a little bit, but it's not enough. And so you actively have to pump more hydrogen back into the urine. And that's done by an ATPase. So that's that hydrogen ATPase. And then the third thing that has to happen is there has to be no back leak between the urine back into the blood. Okay, so you have these three steps. You basically need your ENaC to pump sodium across to set up that gradient. Your hydrogen needs to be kind of put back into the urine in one of its either titratable forms or as ammonium. And then you need to not have leak. And so each of those three things can have something that goes wrong that leads to a distal RTA. I'm going to start with actually the second one because it's what we call classic distal RTA and it's what we see the most. So that's hydrogen ATPase. And so this is classic distal RTA. When that hydrogen ATPase is broken, you basically get failure to reacidify your urine. So with any of these distal RTAs, you're going to have a high urine pH because you are unable to get your hydrogen into your urine. So this is really what helps you differentiate between a distal and a proximal RTA is what your urine pH is.
And that's pH of what, 5.5 or so?
5.5 or so. Usually someone with a distal RTA is going to have a urine pH of like 6 or so, 6, 6.5, but is unable to get it much lower. So that's the kind of classic distal RTA. In patients we're thinking about, this is usually something that's caused by a genetic difference, right? So this is something that is a genetic alteration, but that is what we usually will see as kind of a classic presentation. These children tend to have hypokalemia, so they tend to have normal or low potassium as well. So the second cause of kind of on this pathway, remember we talked about ENaC first, and then we talked about this hydrogen ATPase, and then we talked about not having leak. So the second most common one, which is probably the most common actual presentation of RTA, is when we have abnormalities in the ENaC channel. So that's sodium absorption. So you can have genetic differences in ENaC. But a lot of times, anything that alters that distal epithelium, so any part of that distal convoluted tubule, is going to alter the way that the ENaC channel works. So things like urinary obstruction, UTI, and then medications actually directly work on this as well. So amiloride. And then sometimes we'll also see this in children with sickle cell. But these are kind of the classic presentations of this kind of abnormal ENaC. So these kids actually tend to have normal or high potassium because of this kind of abnormality in sodium reabsorption and what it does in terms of your potassium excretion. So you're unable to excrete your potassium if you're unable to reabsorb your sodium. So the classic hallmark of this kind of altered ENaC is a patient who has normal or high serum potassium in the setting of a distal RTA-like picture.
So the thing I think that might separate us, I think we're, so physiologically, this makes perfect sense, right? Like you block the ENaC channels can't have sodium that comes in and exchanges for potassium. So therefore the potassium's high. And as a result, you end up with a high potassium. You also are distal problems. So you can't get hydrogen into the urine. And so therefore you still have a basic urine pH. And that, and then, so that's like the only, the big difference is the high potassium versus the low potassium based on the fact that you have an ENaC channel that's broken versus not. Now, that ends up, if I'm understanding correctly, the pieces where we all get confused, are those also have different RTA names, right? You're putting them all under a distal RTA, but they also have other names or numbers associated with them. Is that correct?
So there's sometimes, this is where I think it might get a little controversial. Yeah. There is this type 4 RTA, which I think about as like a slightly separate bucket than that kind of ENaC abnormality.
Gotcha. So okay. But also has potassium issues. So this is where it gets really confusing. Yeah. Okay. All right. This actually is making a lot of sense. I've had a lot of issues with this in medical school and never really was able to put it together. So now I'm getting it. I love this.
So just to kind of like recap and go over this again, because I think it's really, it makes sense when you think about the physiology, but I think can get really confusing when you're just trying to kind of fit lab abnormalities. So remember, in order to get rid of your hydrogen in the distal tubule, you need your sodium reabsorbed first to set up that gradient. You then need to use that gradient to pump your hydrogen back into the urine, and then you need that intact epithelium. So the difference between this like ENaC abnormality and what you're thinking about, which is a type 4 RTA, is really what the mechanism is, okay? So type 4 RTA, we'll talk about in a little bit, is more driven by aldo and aldosterone than anything else. With a type 1 or a distal RTA, that's because of abnormal ENaC function. It's because that channel isn't working and the subsequent downstream consequences. So we classically see this in kids who are admitted with either a urinary obstruction or with a bad pyelo. So if you have a kid who has a metabolic acidosis, hyperkalemia, in the setting of a pyelo, it's probably a transient distal RTA from abnormal ENaC function. We've actually had kids who show up with a concern for RTA. You should always send the urine for a UTI, because this sometimes is one of those tricky presentations, particularly in a baby that can't tell you about dysuria.
Cool. And this is all considered a a type 1 RTA. So that's why when people say that there's both high or low potassium in a type 1 RTA, this is the reason why, is because there's two different mechanisms with which the system can go wrong.
Absolutely.
You said that there are three things going with in the distal tubule that can cause an RTA, right? So there right now we have three types of RTA, type 1, type 2, and type 4, but then there are maybe three types of type 1 RTA?
Yeah, there kind of are. I mean, they're just based on kind of what's going wrong. I mean, fortunately, they all kind of make sense and they're stepwise related. But yes, you can have abnormalities in the ENaC channel. You can have abnormalities in your sodium ATPase. And then you could also have leakiness of that kind of membrane. So the only real thing that causes that leakiness is amphotericin B. But amphotericin B basically punches holes in that membrane and so causes back leak. So you can get a distal RTA like picture if a patient is on amphotericin because that gradient really can't be maintained.
All right. So for me, who's usually not using a lot of amphoterrible, I don't have to worry about the third type of type 1 RTA.
Yes. Okay. You can cross that one off your list. Yes.
I'll look at it again when I have to restudy for my boards, but otherwise, in my clinical knowledge, it's just going to stay on the page.
And then I think let's just briefly talk about type 4 RTA, just to kind of round out the shop. So type 4 RTA in some ways is the most straightforward and quite honestly, the one that we see the least of. That may be because our endocrinology colleagues often get involved in these patients as well. But this is a hyporeninemic, hypoaldosterone-like picture. The metabolic acidosis is usually not as severe. So we're talking like bicarbs of 19 to 22, as opposed to these like 12 to 14 profound metabolic acidoses. They often will have high, or they will kind of uniformly have hyperkalemia. And this is usually kind of pretty extreme hyperkalemia. So why does this happen? Like, what is the mechanism? So it's all actually driven by your hyperkalemia. So whatever pathway you get to hyperkalemia, what basically happens is that you are unable to conjugate your ammonia to ammonium because you have too much potassium. And so you're unable to really couple that hydrogen to excrete it. So for whatever mechanism, whether it's CAH or diabetes or a medication like RAS or something like that inhibition, the primary kind of driving mechanism is that hyperkalemia and then that resulting failure to kind of conjugate your ammonia to ammonium to get rid of your titratable acids.
So now we've done like a great big overview of all the RTAs. I think we have a pretty good idea. I think, Steve, maybe should we get back to our case and figure out what we're going to do, that we now have an idea of how to diagnose how we're going to manage each of these?
Yeah, that sounds great. So just to recap, so we have a 12-month-old who's presenting with, the lab derangements we previously described, has a positive urine anion gap, a urine pH of 6.5, and a renal ultrasound showing diffuse nephrocalcinosis. So kind of jumping a little bit into diagnosis, this would be consistent with a type 1 or distal RTA. So Michelle, how would you go about treating a patient like this if they presented to you?
So you're absolutely right. So the urine pH is really the thing that helps point you in the right direction here. The major difference between the different types of RTAs is not necessarily what the treatment is, but how much you have to give. And this really all goes back to the underlying physiology. So type 1 or distal RTA is actually far easier to treat. It requires far less bicarb. And the reason is because all you really have to make up for is that daily acid load. Because the proximal tubule is still able to do all of the reclamation, it's really that distal tubule. So the kind of hallmark of the management of a type 1 distal RTA is that they need some bicarb, but it's usually a mild to moderate amount, and we're usually able to get their serum bicarb into a very reasonable level. So you're going to treat them with bicarb. You're probably going to do some other investigations to kind of try and uncover what the underlying cause is. In this infant, you're probably going to get some genetic testing. because that's probably going to give you your answer. In this infant, you also, particularly if you're on a PEDS NEF board stem, you would probably also consider getting hearing testing because a couple of these genetic manifestations also have concomitant hearing loss. But if you're in the real world, you probably would just do an audiology test. So you're going to start there, and then you're going to start the patient on some bicarb, and you're going to titrate until you get their serum bicarb to a good level.
And just for us, what would you start with? Sorry, Chris and I have the exact same question at the exact same time.
Practically, how do we do this?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yes. And you've also been, yeah. So like, what sodium bicarb do we use? How do we give it, you know, kind of the real basics of how should we be prescribing this?
Yeah, so sodium bicarb's a little tricky. Some of this is also driven by what insurance will approve and what formulation you're able to get, especially if your patient is not in a pill swallowing age. So we have several different options in terms of bicarb. So we have pills. There are, you know, big pills, so 650s and then 325s. And then you also have liquids as well. There's also the fail safe of baking soda, which we actually use quite a bit of as well. So the important thing to remember about any sort of bicarb is how many millimoles you're getting per amount. So the just to give you a sense, so the 650s are 8 millimoles per pill. The 325s are 4 millimoles. And then 1 teaspoon of baking soda, so not tablespoon, teaspoon is 60. So the reason that's really nice for small children is that a teaspoon of baking soda is probably easier for them to take than pills or a whole mess of kind of reconstituted sodium bicarb, which is incredibly salty and makes most of the kids I prescribe it vomit. And it's also something that is much easier to get over the counter. Usually when we think about where we're starting with a distal RTA, we think about what the daily acid load is. So in a normal kid on a normal Western diet, we start usually around like 2 to 4 millimoles per kilo. And then we just titrate to effect. Now the proximals are different and you have to pour bicarbonate into these kids to get them to grow. But really what we're monitoring once we start someone on therapy is what's their serum bicarb, but then are they able to grow? Are they in a place where they are in a positive enough metabolic state where their growth starts to recover? And then also thinking about, are there any other abnormalities that go along with whatever their defect is that we need to deal with? So, you know, in a kid that has high urine calcium, do we need to think about kind of their risk of stones? In someone with hypokalemia, do we need to think about supplementing them with some potassium? With someone with some other defect, do we need to think about other pieces as well?
So these are cases where, you know, obviously the RTA is going to be going on for a long time. So your treatment's going to be sole and sure, make sure they get oral replenishment and that treats it. But with Sola Fail to Thrive, I was, you know, sometimes it can be pretty bad. Do they, if they're ever brought into the hospital, is there ever a time where you need to be more aggressive? Or are you still doing like, make sure they have nutrition and their fluids and start them on oral bicarb? Do we ever have to worry about like supplementing with like IV bicarb in some of these patients or not?
So sometimes we'll use IV bicarb to kind of dig us out of a hole and get us into a better place, particularly in a patient who's critically ill. The thing I often have to remind people is that even though we are very upset and worried about the red numbers, that patient has probably been living there for quite a period of time. And so even though it is an emergency in our brains because of the level of acidemia and that bicarb, it's probably not an emergency to that patient. But most of the time, yes, we do treat with IV bicarb to get them into a more steady state and kind of get them back above or closer to that threshold of where we want them to be. And then we'll switch them over. I will say that most of our patients with a chronic RTA, so something that is, you know, Fanconi or a genetic, end up with a feeding tube just because of the amount of medications and supplements that they need.
So let's go ahead and move on to our next case. So we have a new patient. Her name is Mia Uren. She's a 3-year-old girl with a history of partial onset seizures. She's on therapy with topiramate. She's coming to clinic with her parents for ongoing evaluation of weakness, constipation, poor weight gain. Her mother states that for the last several months, she's appeared more fatigued than usual, and lately she's been asking her parents to carry her up the stairs to go to bed at night. Basic labs are significant for a sodium level of 139, a potassium of 2.8, a chloride of 115, bicarbonate of 12, and phosphate of 2.9. Urine analysis collected in clinic demonstrates a urine pH of 5.5, and a urine calcium to creatinine ratio is 0.3. You send urine lights and calculate a urine anion gap, which is 2. So we've spent some time differentiating between type 1 and type 2 RTAs. So how do we conceptualize this case now as it compares to our previous case in terms of diagnosis and ultimate treatment for this patient?
So I think the things that are really helpful here are to think about the things in the question stem that really help us point more one direction or the other. So the first thing we need to just remember, right, if this wasn't our second RTA case, is to start by thinking about, is this truly an RTA? To truly say, you know, that this smells like an RTA, it looks like an RTA, it's an RTA, but truly to feel confident, any nephrologist worth their salt is going to say, get a VBG and prove that the patient is acidemic as well. But this is a patient who definitely has a low pH. They have a non-GAP acidosis. The things that really stick out to me when I'm thinking about this case is the urine pH, how low that serum bicarb is, right? So remember we talked about the severity and where those serum bicarbs usually land. This is a very severe non-GAP acidosis, and then the potassium as well. So when we're thinking about kind of where are we thinking with this, before we get the kind of, you know, the medication kind of invoked as a kind of common cause, I'm already thinking of proximal RTA just because the severity of the acidemia, the low potassium, and then the urine pH is all kind of pointing me in a proximal tubular direction.
And it sounds like we've essentially made that diagnosis kind of off the bat of what we just kind of talked about in the previous case. We don't need genetic testing, for example, or those things to make these diagnoses. It's made with, you know, ruling out the other pieces, proving that it is, in fact, an RTA, and then, you know, kind of checking that that urine pH. And so let's go ahead and just say this is what we call a proximal RTA or a type 2 RTA. You mentioned that treatment is pretty significant in the amount of bicarb we need to give this patient. So first, I guess I'll ask it in two parts right now. But like number one, you know, what are we starting with for giving supplemental bicarb? And number two, is there any underlying illness treatments that we should be aware of?
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about kind of the three buckets of kind of causes of RTA. So with proximal tubulopathies or proximal RTAs, it's very similar as well, right? So genetic causes. We think about other syndromic, other systemic illnesses, and then we think about medications. So with proximal tubulopathy, the two medications I think about are topiramate, which also is highly associated with stone disease, particularly because of the proximal tubulopathy it causes, and then acetazolamide as well, which is just because of how it works. But topiramate is the one that I see actually quite a bit of proximal RTA in clinic as a result of. So this is a patient where the clinical story is making it seem like topiramate is probably the most likely cause. And if this is a patient that could be switched to another anti-epileptic, this would certainly be an indication for thinking about a switch in therapy because the management of proximal tubulopathy and proximal RTA is so challenging given the amount of bicarb. So that actually would be my first treatment option would be to actually think about switching seizure medications because of the side effect profile. Now, it's not usually a type 2, but the other medicine I often will think about in terms of an RTA is lithium. So lithium, when we think about distal causes, can also cause kind of some abnormalities and can cause a distal RTA-like picture. But when we think about topiramate, really we're thinking about proximal tubulopathy. We're thinking about this severe RTA, and we're thinking about calcium phosphate stones as well.
So with the topiramate, you were saying that first treatment would be trying to switch the patient off topiramate. Will that do the trick? Like, will I do that and then like it will all slowly get better and I don't have to stress at all? Or do I still have to be like, all right, this is going to take us, like this kidney's going to take a while to start functioning again. I have to start some bicarb for the next couple weeks or something.
Yeah, this patient's definitely going to need some bicarb in kind of the interim until that effect is lost on the kidney. In my experience, this is something that is a mostly reversible effect. I've had a couple of kids who have some kind of mild proximal or tubular dysfunction that remains afterwards, but it's not to the degree of this like massive bicarbonate loss. So this is a patient where you're going to need very high doses of bicarb. You know, we are talking starting kind of 5 to 10 millimoles per kilo. But, you know, when you think about what that means in terms of the pill burden or the amount of medication burden, it's very, very high. And really what you're doing is you're just trying to titrate to a serum bicarb that allows the patient to grow. You're never, because of the threshold of maximum reabsorption in the proximal tubule, you're never going to truly normalize your serum bicarb, and you actually may make the other abnormalities worse. So we really, with a bad proximal tubulopathy or bad proximal tubule RTA, are really just trying to get them kind of to that 18 to 20 and keep them in a place where they're not, you know, failing to thrive, if that makes sense.
And it sounds like you mentioned that baking soda is the most concentrated way to get bicarbonate by a long shot. What do you generally, just from your own experience, mix it into? You know, what are these kids taking those baking soda teaspoon? Are they just taking them just straight water and mixed in? Oh, it's not like in a applesauce or something, or just water and baking soda?
Water and baking soda. So this is a lot of our kids, you know, you can get reconstituted sodium bicarb for kids who aren't able to take pills. But I think even some of our older children actually prefer the sodium bicarb, or the baking soda route, because the volume is less than pill burden. So remember our exercise at the beginning about how much bicarb do you actually have to take in order to do the job of the kidney? These kids, if they are taking pills, are taking 4 to 6 pills 4 to 6 times a day. So it's a really high pill burden, which is why a lot of these kids actually have G-tubes, because it makes it easier to kind of keep up with that medication need.
What does sodium bicarb and water taste like? Does anyone know? I've never tried it. Is it just very chemically? Like, I don't know. I think we should do another challenge for our listeners. Sodium bicarb and water, maybe not too much, but just a little taste.
Yeah, don't overdo it. You'll get alkalotic real soon. Yeah.
Anything else we can learn from this case, Steve?
The only other question I had is, you know, with the low phosphate level, is this a kiddo that you would think about Fanconi syndrome for? And what other testing would you do if that were the case? Or do you not need to do any other testing if this is medication related?
So Fanconi syndrome is usually something that we think of a diffuse proximal tubular abnormality. And so usually your urinalysis, just your straight urine dip, is going to give you clues. You're going to see protein, you're going to see glucose. So with a urine that is otherwise bland, you need to be a little bit less concerned about that. But it is certainly something that we worry about in patients who have this sort of presentation.
Awesome. Should we move on to the next case then?
Okay, I can start us with our last case. So now we have Rena Stone. She's a 15-year-old female with a history of type 1 diabetes diagnosed at an early age. She was seen by her pediatrician for a routine healthcare maintenance visit, at which time she had labs drawn that showed the following: sodium 141, potassium 5.2, chloride 111, bicarbonate 18. A VBG was drawn and showed a serum pH of 7.1. Urine pH is 5.3, and a urine anion gap is calculated at -1. So can you tell us, you know, thinking about the different types of RTA, once again, we go through, we decide that, yes, this is a true non-anion gap metabolic acidosis. There's no other clinical features to suggest something other than an RTA, sort of which RTA we're thinking about here. And then you had touched a little bit on this previously, but sort of the clinical associations with this type of RTA.
Yeah. So this one is one that's kind of a borderline RTA, right? So, you know, your urine net charge is slightly negative. Now, this is one where I probably would clinically follow this kid and repeat labs in a couple of weeks and see where things evolve. The question is whether this truly is an RTA that is just slightly masked right now because of that sodium, or excuse me, because of that potassium, or whether this is something that is just a slight metabolic derangement. So this is one that I would probably have them repeat serum and urine labs in 2 to 4 weeks and see where things are at. Now, if we repeat labs and we have a slightly higher potassium and a urine GAP that is now positive, then I would put this more squarely in the type 4 RTA. So type 4 RTA is kind of the stepsister of type 1 RTA. So it's very similar in terms of the mechanism, but the etiology and the pathophysiology is slightly different. So type 4 RTA, like we talked about before, is driven due to your hyperkalemic state. So it's a hyporeninemic, hypoaldosterone-like picture. So you can have this with straight CAH or any of the aldosterone deficiencies, but you also get it in the setting of things that cause hyperkalemia. So what happens with a hyperkalemia, just to remind everybody, is that you basically can't couple your ammonia to your ammonium, and so you don't really acidify your urine. So the kind of clinical findings that we'll see are high potassium. The urine is a little bit variable, but usually it's going to be more like a type 1 urine, but it's usually somewhere in the middle. It's usually in that kind of can't really decide whether it's appropriate or not place. You're going to have mild metabolic acidosis, so it's going to be somewhere in the high teens, low 20s. And you're usually going to kind of see either a medication exposure or a clinical story that kind of gives you a hint of where you're going. So, you know, the diabetes certainly fits nicely with a type 4 RTA. Also things that I would think about with someone that's on RAS inhibition, so an ACE inhibitor or an ARB, or someone who has either a known diagnosis or suspected diagnosis of CAH or some sort of aldosterone abnormality.
What about CKD? Can CKD, especially as it gets worse, it can lead to high potassium? Do we see that in this area as well?
You absolutely can, but you get metabolic acidosis in CKD for several different reasons as well. So yes, you certainly can get kind of a partial type 4 picture, but you also just get abnormalities and decreased ability to secrete your distal or your daily acid load, just intrinsic of your decreased glomerular filtration. And so those two things kind of couple together.
And I guess we'll get into treatment, you know, the kind of the same way that we were talking about before. So it sounds like potassium is your main driver in this case. So is this treated with bicarbonate or is it treated with antipotassium meds?
So yes, this is where you pull out the antipotassium meds. Really, this is where you think about, like, do I care about the serum bicarb of 19 or do I care about the potassium of 6.2? And so really you have to think about, you know, what is the major driver and what's the thing I actually need to target? So this is a patient where I would think about, you know, do they need to be on a diuretic or something to deal with the kind of primary driver of their kind of hyperkalemia? Yeah, they probably need a little bit better glucose control, and maybe that'll make everything a little bit better. But, you know, do we need to do something about their potassium as opposed to truly doing something about their acid base disturbance? So what I would do with this patient is probably over the next couple of weeks, think about how do we do some sort of any sort of potassium lowering approach, right? Sometimes they're on medications or things like that that directly are either potassium containing, diet supplements, things like that. And then I would think about repeating labs and truly seeing where we were at a couple of weeks later.
Is there any role for, synthetic mineralocorticoid agents like fludrocortisone was one thing that came up?
So there absolutely are. The question in my mind usually is, it's more of a band-aid than it is truly dealing with what the underlying causes, unless you truly have some sort of kind of renin-aldosterone mediated problem. So I certainly have used them in situations where the potassium needs to be controlled and the acid-base balance needs to be better urgently. But I often find it's better to try and figure out kind of what the primary driver is. But yes, you absolutely can use fludrocortisone or any of those other medications acutely. But I think you really need to figure out kind of what the underlying driver is first.
Awesome. I feel like, you know, we spent all this time in the beginning trying to, you know, walk through all these RTAs, and then boom, as soon as we did that, like each of these cases just fell into place. Before we move on even more, Chris, did you want to ask about your type three?
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. Of course, I've been talking about this offline well before we even started recording. I'm like, one and two and four, what happened to type three? So please tell us what happened to type three, because I feel like it's like three's like the loneliest number here, and like what happened to it?
Yeah, so type 3 was discovered and then was undiscovered. So basically, the thought is that type 3 is kind of a combination of a proximal and a tubular, or sorry, a proximal and a distal RTA. Now, I actually think that there is this phenomenon of kind of diffuse tubular dysfunction that probably best fits in neonates, quite honestly. So babies, particularly premature babies, just have abnormal acid handling. And so I think what people are actually trying to describe with this type 3 is just abnormal or immature tubular acid handling. And so I think RTA type 3 probably exists. It's just the neonatal type, and it's transient. And as babies get closer to term, they start to outgrow it. But it's really common that babies will have a non-GAP metabolic acidosis early on, just because their bicarbonate reabsorption is not fully mature. They have a high daily acid load, and they are unable to fully secrete it. So they have abnormalities in basically every single portion of the nephron when it comes to their bicarbonate and their acid ham.
We should bring this back, and we'll just rename it like the type 3 star RTA variant or something like that.
I like it.
All right. All right. So we've done all the RTAs. What's left? Steve, where are we, man?
So I'm starting to think long-term now. So if we have a patient in front of us who we've diagnosed with an RTA, whether in the hospital or otherwise, what does long-term follow-up look like for these patients? Should they have a nephrologist following their care if the, you know, their bicarb is sort of normalized or in the process of normalizing? Is this something that the PCP can manage on their own? What's your approach?
So it depends a little bit about whether this is a transient RTA or something that is a fixed defect. So transient defects, so things like either an infection or a medication that the kind of stimulus is going to be removed, probably need to be kind of managed acutely by a nephrologist for that kind of bicarbonate titration, but may not need to see a nephrologist long term. The kids that certainly need nephrologists in their life are the kids who have underlying genetic defects or true Fanconi syndrome, where these defects are going to persist. And the reason is that these kids are really hard to manage. And they are both degree of bicarbonate supplementation that they need, but then also the other concomitant kidney problems and other systemic kind of involvement is pretty profound. And a lot of these cases and these kids actually go on to develop CKD and can have progressive chronic kidney disease depending on what the abnormalities are. So I'm thinking there's a couple of syndromes. So one's called Dent disease, one's called Lowe's syndrome. Both of those present with a proximal tubulopathy and then can march to CKD and end-stage kidney disease. So if this is particularly a proximal tubulopathy, particularly something that has been diagnosed as persistent, yes, these patients need to follow with nephrology because really getting their acid-base balance in a place where they can grow and develop and thrive is very challenging and requires very close titration.
Got it. And for those kids that we diagnose early, we start on appropriate treatment, are outcomes favorable otherwise in those kiddos?
Yeah, I mean, I think as long as you can get kids to a place where they're tolerating their bicarbonate supplementation and are able to keep themselves in a good balance, absolutely, they can have really good outcomes. I think the challenging thing is that anytime there's a growth spurt or a kid changes in terms of their developmental needs, their bicarbonate needs also change as well. You know, kids with proximal RTA are much trickier to manage and more commonly will have worse outcomes than those with distal RTA, where we can really find a good kind of sweet spot of medication that they can then grow with.
And so, you know, just say we are managing these you know, how often are we checking labs? You know, like, it, you know, it sounds like this bicarbonate, you know, requirements can go up and down, left and right, based on all these things you just mentioned. Is this something that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, we have an RTA, we're following these labs every 3 months to try to adjust our bicarb, every week, every 2 weeks? You know, what are we kind of looking at here for how we follow these kids?
So this is where you get my favorite, it depends, answer. Yeah. Early on, when you're trying to figure out kind of where their needs are, I mean, these are kids who are either inpatient while we're finding the appropriate amount of bicarbonate supplementation and switching them to enteral, or they're getting labs at least once a week. Now, once we have a kid who is doing well and thriving, usually we're checking labs monthly or every other month, except for in periods of growth where we really feel like we need to titrate more aggressively. But most of the time, kids' growth charts and the kind of their other signs of how they are doing tell us when we need to reassess kind of how we're doing in terms of our bicarbonate delivery.
And then when you do check that, do you check a pH, a BMP? Do you do all the urine stuff, or do you kind of leave that alone at the time?
I usually leave that alone depending on what else is going on. So really, you know, just a renal function panel. So you're checking your bicarb, your other electrolytes. Really, it depends what your underlying etiology is, right? If you have a diffuse proximal RTA, you're going to need to check your phosphorus and your potassium and probably be monitoring renal ultrasounds to make sure that your calcium phosphate stones are okay. So the challenges may look different. You know, with a kid with cystinosis, you know, these kids have bad Fanconi syndrome. They have other systemic disease. So you're seeing these kids every month, lab panels, urine panels, ultrasounds, thyroid tests. So it really depends on the underlying etiology and how closely you're following them.
Is there anything else you want to hit? Michelle, is there anything else you want our, you know, we've talked a good amount of time. Is there anything else left that we really need to know about RTAs?
No, I mean, I think, you know, the most important thing when you're thinking about RTA is to think about the other things it could be first. Confirm that you have a non-ion gap metabolic acidosis, and then get urine studies. After that, you take a deep breath, you look things up, and you go from there.
Great. So with that, I think we can go ahead and wrap up here. So I'll kind of take us home with a couple of questions here at the end. Michelle, do you have any main take-home points for our listeners today?
So I think the main take-home points are that non-anion gap metabolic acidosis can be several things, including RTA. If you're worried about RTA, check a VBG and electrolytes. If those are consistent, then check urine studies so you can get a urine gap. At that point, consult your friendly nephrologist.
Awesome. Those are great. Thank you again for hanging out with us. It was great. I relearned so many things in this last hour and a half. It was amazing. Again, you're amazing. This is the reason why you've come back 4 times. I think it's the most number of anyone else, right? Like,
this is it.
Yes, you have the crown.
You exactly. Gotta stay in the lead, though. We gotta bring you back for more.
So, see, coming back for 5th guest, what do you get? So you got a jacket this time. Maybe you get a
crown. I would like a crown. Yes.
All right. Well, make sure we send you a crown. We should send you some stickers or something like that for all this work that you've done for us.
Well, thank you guys. It's always so fun to talk about this stuff. And, you know, it's really a pleasure to be able to do this with you guys.
Awesome.
Thanks so much, Michelle.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
Yeah, of course. Bye.
This has been another episode of the Cribsiders.
It's for the kids!
Get show notes and sign up for our bi-weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producer for this episode, Dr. Steve Wilson, and our wonderful social media team, both on Twitter, X, Instagram, Blue Sky, led by Denise Cruz. I've been Sam Mazur.
I've been Steve Wilson.
And this has been Chris the Chew Manchu. Thank you and good night. And if you've made it all the way to the end, you get to be graced by a poem written by AI. It's called The Balance of Tiny Filters. Deep in nephrons, small and precise, acid-base balance hangs on a knife. Renotubular acidosis speaks in patterns that pediatricians must seek. Type 1 shows distal tubes amiss, failing to secrete the acid kiss. Potassium wanes as bicarbonate flees, and stones may form with stubborn ease. In type 2, proximal tubes refuse to reclaim what they should not lose. Bicarbonate spills, wasting away, while bone minerals slowly fray. Type 4 whispers with high K's tail when aldosterone signals fail. Hyperkalemic and mildly acidic, a puzzle for the nephrologist critic. Growth falters and muscles may tire as biochemical storms transpire. With alkali therapy, we restore the balance these children are seeking for. Through blood gas readings and urine pH, anion gaps telling what we can't see, we piece together the tubular song to guide each child where they belong. All right, guys, see you later.